Today is just not any regular day, okay? Today, and it's almost 3 years since we had our last class in person.
Amazing.
And would you believe it that today is the anniversary of the printing of the Tanya?
Oh, perfect timing.
Cool.
Could you imagine? The first time that the Tanya was put to print was today, over 200 years ago. The Alter Rebbe actually wanted it to be printed Yotes Kislev, which was yesterday, and Hashem had it planned for today. So today is the anniversary of the printing of the Tanya. And the Alter Rebbe explained, what is this Tanya for? Actually, it seemed like impossible. It was such a resistance to print it. Why print a book like this? There was so much resistance. And in the introduction to the book, the Alter Rebbe said that a book like this should not be published. And then he went ahead and said, now I'll tell you why I published the book. And he said, the reason why it can't be published is because the ideas that I am conveying in this book are meant to be passed down teacher to student. In order to share these kind of ideas, you have to look at your student, know them, talk to their heart. These kind of things you can't just read in a book.
The whole oral law, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. Jill said it's the whole oral law, and that's true in that it requires, you know, I read this interesting article years ago by Dr. Susan Handelman, and she said that people call us the people of the book. And she said, I can't call us that. We're the people of the tradition, the Masorah. Because books are important, but the most important element is passing down from teacher to student. And so the Alter Rebbe said, I am writing a book, and this is something that has to be passed down teacher to student. But I'm not just writing something that I think, or I'm not just taking books and putting it down on a paper. I'm doing it the way it's done, teacher to student. And how is that? He said, people have asked me questions over the last 20 years. They poured out their hearts to me, and I gave them answers, and I am transcribing those answers in this book. Now, clearly, if you look at the Tanya, it's not a question and answer book. It is a book that's written with structure and build up. But the Alter Rebbe could not write it in a form of question and answer, because if you write it in a form of question and answer, a lot of questions have the same answer. But if you write just one question, you won't realize that your answer is there. So he takes the core answers, he puts them in this book, and then he doesn't take the teacher to student connection out of the book. He says, I'm begging the elders of the community, if somebody cannot find their answer in the book, you need to help them find the answer in the book. And don't be humble, false humility, and say, I don't know the answer. The Alter Rebbe said that's actually a terrible thing. False humility in not helping somebody serve Hashem is a terrible thing. And if you help somebody find their answer in the book, then Hashem will light up both of your eyes. You'll help them find wisdom, you'll gain greater wisdom. And Tanya is a book that helps us get in touch with our core self and our purpose in life. And it comes in stages. At the beginning, the Alter Rebbe gives us this breakthrough idea. You don't have to be a tzaddik. In fact, most people cannot be a tzaddik. Now, when he said you don't have to be a tzaddik, he didn't mean you don't have to act like a tzaddik. You have to act like a tzaddik, but your struggles will remain. You will have thoughts that come to a wicked person, and that's fine, but it's you who are in control. It's up to you to decide, are you going to host the thought or are you going to reject the thought? And that's because, here's another breakthrough idea he gave us. The reason why you have these thoughts, like on one hand, you were just doing the most amazing thing. You were doing chesed, you were helping other people, you were praying, you went to shul, you studied Torah. And then you're acting like a hooligan. And I'm like, who am I? Am I this person or that person? He said, you know what? You don't just have one soul. You have two souls. A Jewish person has two souls. They have an animal soul and they have a divine, godly soul. And the struggle is, who are we going to identify with? Now, we don't get to choose who is our identity, because our identity is actually our divine soul. So people who have tried to repress that never felt very good. They said, you know what? They don't want to be Jewish. You know, like Groucho Marx said he would never be part of a club that would have him, because he only wanted to be part of a club that said they won't have any Jews. Too bad. You are going to be Jewish whether or not you're going to ascribe to that. Your identity is going to be your divine soul whether or not you're going to admit it. But who to identify with, that's our choice. So we started off we're in the middle of chapter 41 right now. And we started off by talking about this comes to follow. This chapter comes to follow a whole treatment on why it's important to serve Hashem with intentions. And what are these intentions? What is this kavana? It is intentions of love, wanting to connect to Him, and fear of ever being separated from Him. And in general, this kavana is when it propels the mitzvah, it's what makes the mitzvah come alive. It's what we can see that this mitzvah is about Hashem. Suddenly the energy, the godly energy in the mitzvah becomes apparent. Our connection to the mitzvah becomes apparent. The feelings in the mitzvah energize the mitzvah. The mitzvah is always godly, even if a person does it in a very dry manner, almost like they're forced. The mitzvah is always holy. However, the person doesn't identify with the mitzvah, so they don't feel that vibe. And they also don't reveal what the essence of the mitzvah is. So the focus until now was you need to do the mitzvah with love. And fear was also mentioned, but it wasn't emphasized. This chapter took a whole new perspective. It was like, if you ever thought you can get away without having fear, we were wrong. And it became a whole different kind of attitude. Like, not only do we have to stay away from transgressions by having fear of Hashem, but we even have to do a positive mitzvah, not just in a movement of love. Why do we do a mitzvah? I love Hashem. I want to connect to Him. Well, we know how to connect to another person. How do we connect to Hashem? There's only one way to connect to Hashem, and it's through the Torah and mitzvahs. The Zohar calls the mitzvahs Evarin Demalka, the limbs of the king. They are Hashem's limbs, as it were. What are limbs? That's what expresses our life energy in this world. Our soul is expressed through our limbs. Hashem is expressed through His mitzvahs. Those are His limbs. And when we do a mitzvah, in the fourth chapter of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe said, it's like somebody who is hugging the king. We want to connect to Him. We want to hug Him. The only way is by doing a mitzvah. You know, people think like, I could go into a mountaintop and I can just meditate and I will be close to Hashem. No, that's pseudo connection. Because Hashem is infinite and we are finite. A finite being cannot bridge the gap to the infinite. The only way the infinite gap can be bridged is by Hashem throwing us a rope. And He did, by Torah and mitzvahs. Meditation is important, as long as it propels that true connection of a mitzvah. And at the beginning of that chapter, the Alter Rebbe said that fear has to motivate not just our staying away from transgressions, it even has to meditate our doing a positive mitzvah. And he said the fear that you need to have is a very basic kind of fear, because there's many levels of fear. Very basic kind of fear. It's the fear of ever rebelling against Hashem. A Jewish person has a divine soul with its nature, its very nature, is it yearns to be connected to Hashem. It's the craziest thing. Shlomo HaMelech says, Ki ner Hashem nishmas adam. The candle of Hashem is the soul of man. And a flame is always leaping upwards. Why is a flame leaping upwards? Because it wants to connect to its source. The Zohar says it's in the sublunar sphere. So even though you hold the candle upside down, the flame will go upwards. Even though it's going to lose its identity by leaving the wick and escaping to its source, but that's what it wants to do. That is the nature of the Jewish soul. It just wants to be subsumed within Hashem. It's always yearning and striving. And that's why Jews have a basic sense of just not being satisfied. I'm trying to think of the exact word. Yeah. Unsatiated. Discontent. So we have this, you know, other people, they can like do well in business, they can do well in the social arena, and then they'll have this certain type of satisfaction. That's just not going to cut it for us. You can be the richest person on planet Earth, you can be the most famous person on planet Earth, you can have all the kind of comforts that any comfort-seeking creature is going to want, and as a Jewish person, you won't feel satisfied. You'll always have that fire burning underneath you. You'll be like, what's it? Why am I not satisfied? Why do I always want more? We're yearning for what we can't even grasp. We're literally yearning for the infinite. We want to be one with Hashem. Now, that love that we have for Him is natural. We don't have to create it. We can't create it, and we also can't do away with it. For some people, they would like to do away with it. They cannot. Part of that love is a fear. It's a fear of ever being separated from Him. A Jewish person is afraid to ever be separated from Hashem. And that's why we have these crazy stories throughout history of Jewish people who did not live a religious life, who lived an even immoral life, like the famous story of Yossel, the holy ganav, in Berdichev. There's a grave marked, "Here lies Yosef, the holy thief." And what kind of story is that? The holy thief? Doesn't sound very holy to me. But the story of Yossel is he was a thief. And one day he said to himself, "I'm going to be making myself happy with these petty little thieveries that I make. Do you know that the church has this great golden statue? He's just going to get that." So he breaks into the church and he was caught. And they were going to burn him because it wasn't just thievery to them. It was sacrilege. And they said to him, "Listen," he was just at the stake. And they said, "If you will convert to Christianity, not only aren't we going to burn you, we're going to exempt you from all charges. You won't even be charged for being a thief." And he said, maybe he's a thief, and maybe he never kept the things he was supposed to keep, but he's a Jew, and he will die as a Jew. He will never be separated from Hashem. And that is a story that happened many times in Jewish history. And that's because at that moment, when a Jew comes to the face this moment of truth, am I with Hashem, or will God forbid I be separated from him? A Jewish person can't rip themselves away from Hashem. Very rarely has it happened that a Jew ripped themselves away from Hashem. It's this fear. It's life itself. I would never give that up. So this is innate to all of us. We all have this fear of Hashem. The question is, do we tap into it? So the Alter Rebbe said that you don't have to tap into it on a way that's on a very high level, where every moment you actually feel that in your heart. There's a very basic level that I want you to feel. Fear of ever rebelling against Hashem. And he gave us a meditation, and he said that you need to think about Hashem's kingship, that it extends from the highest worlds to the lowest worlds. But he only calls himself king by the Jewish people calling him king, and it didn't stop at that. He only calls himself king if I personally call him king, because a person has to say, "For my sake, the world was created." And then we started to look at another meditation that's meant to engender fear. And that is, think about what this Torah is. Think about what this mitzvah is. It's the will of Hashem. For us, as a human being, there's us, and then there's our will, which extends outside of us. For Hashem, his will is him. It's a wild idea. Hashem's will is Hashem. And so when we say Torah and we say mitzvah, it means that Hashem is literally clothed within that Torah and within that mitzvah. And when we study Torah and when we do a mitzvah, we're drawing his infinite light upon our soul that's within our body. Now, the soul that's within our body is part of him, but it has a dissonance, unfortunately. Being clothed in a body, it doesn't feel its connection to Hashem all the time. It doesn't feel the oneness. And suddenly, when we study Torah and we do a mitzvah and we're drawing Hashem's light upon it, it becomes subsumed within its source. And when we realize that our soul is literally just losing itself in Hashem, surrendering and becoming one with him, it brings great awe to us. So far we looked at two meditations meant to bring awe, and we're going to talk about why awe is so important. Because you can say, hey, love is enough. And the Alter Rebbe is going to tell us why love is not enough. So the first meditation was, I never want to rebel against Hashem, and he's relying on me personally to call him king. The heavens and earth, he disregards them all. If I don't call him king, none of that matters to him. He is uniquely focused on me, and I am in his presence. The second meditation was, look at this Torah. Look at this mitzvah. He is clothed within that. I'm drawing that down upon my soul. My soul is becoming subsumed within him. That should engender awe. Now the Alter Rebbe is going to say, even though every single mitzvah has the will of Hashem within it, and all of them are meant to bring about this total surrender. Surrender, I'm just surrendering to Hashem. Every mitzvah has a unique theme, that it has a special property to subsume a different part of our body and our soul to Hashem. There are 248 limbs. There are 248 supernal lights. And each one of our limbs are connected to one of those supernal lights. And when we do a specific mitzvah, it allows us to surrender that particular part of us to Hashem. Now, we're talking so much about surrender, and surrender could feel overwhelming. Like, am I really supposed to give up my ego? Am I really supposed to give up my sense of self? Like, who am I if I don't have an ego? And it reminds me of the way they trap monkeys. So you know how they trap monkeys? They carve out a squash, then they stick some bait inside, and they nail the squash to the floor. And the monkey's hand is big enough to put inside and take out without any bait. But when it sticks his hand inside the squash and grabs the food, it can't pull its hand out of the squash and it's trapped. Now, if it wants its freedom, it can just let go of the food. But of course, it doesn't know that. And all it can think about is this food that I want to have. So it won't let go and it becomes trapped. That's us with our ego. We think like, if I'm not going to hold on to this ego, then what am I going to have? We're not going to hold on to our ego. We're going to have freedom. We're going to be limitless. We're going to be boundless channels of Hashem. But we're so afraid. This is me. I can't let go. But then we're stuck. So surrender is huge. We're thinking, I'm just going to have no agenda of my own. It's just going to be all about Hashem. But that's actually truly who we are. Everyone's looking for happiness. How do we classify happiness? What makes somebody happy? Happiness is seamlessness. Happiness is when everything just works together in one flow, like that zone that they like to talk about, or the flow. Human beings don't experience that on a regular basis. We're fragmented, and we've become fragmented ever since that sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What happened then? You know, before Adam and Eve ate from that tree of knowledge of good and evil, they weren't wearing any clothes. Why weren't they wearing any clothes? There was nothing to be embarrassed about. And the reason why there was nothing to be embarrassed about was because they had no separate sense of self apart from their divine mission in life. And when everything about you is only to channel the divine, there's nothing embarrassing about you. As soon as they ate from that tree of knowledge of good and evil, they suddenly had a sense of self independent of their mission in life. And that is embarrassing. When something about us serves as a channel to something else besides Hashem, that means that we're fragmented. Because we're talking about yielding to Hashem, surrendering to Hashem. But Hashem is our core. He is our deepest self. And if we can just let go of our facade and our external self, then we're yielding to the infinite. So we looked at the meditation of accepting Him as King. We looked at the meditation of surrendering in His light as our soul draws it upon itself through Torah mitzvah. Now we're looking at two mitzvahs and how they engender specific kinds of surrender within our soul. The two mitzvahs that we're going to be looking at are particularly male mitzvahs. So in preparing for class, I'm like, how are we going to do this? Not only are they regular male mitzvahs, like, you know, women are not obligated in time-bound mitzvahs. So for example, women are not obligated in constant Torah study the way men are. Women are not obligated to shake the lulav and esrog like men are. However, we still make a bracha on the Torah and we study Torah. We still make a bracha on the lulav and esrog and we shake the lulav and esrog. But the two mitzvahs that we're studying today, we don't even do. We're not even allowed to do. And they are the mitzvah of tefillin and the mitzvah of tzitzis. So why don't we put on tefillin? Yonatan ben Uziel, he was one of the foremost students of Hillel HaZaken. The Talmud records that when Yonatan ben Uziel would study the Torah, if a bird would fly over his head, it would get burned. Hillel HaZaken had 80 prominent students. The least of them, the least of all his students, was Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the leader of the Jewish people. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, actually we're going to learn about him in this chapter, was one of the greatest people to ever exist in Jewish history, and he was the least of Hillel HaZaken's students. The greatest of Hillel HaZaken's students was Yonatan ben Uziel. Yonatan ben Uziel said that a woman cannot wear tefillin because it is cross-dressing. The Torah forbids a man to wear woman's clothing and forbids a woman to wear man's clothing. And he considers tefillin to be man's clothing. Not all commentators agree with that because they say you cannot have a ritual object that's considered a male's garment. So that wouldn't be enough for a woman not to wear tefillin. But here's why a woman won't wear tefillin. Even for a man to wear tefillin is a huge deal. There was a time in Eastern Europe that some men didn't put on tefillin. Rabbi Moshe of Kusi went around exonerating people to put on tefillin. Why? They were so afraid to put on tefillin because of the extreme holiness required. In order to wear tefillin, while you're wearing tefillin, you cannot be distracted. You have to think about Hashem the whole time. While you're wearing tefillin, you have to maintain extreme purity of body. If a person has to like pass gas, they can't do it while they're wearing tefillin. They have to be in a state of extreme physical and spiritual purity. People used to wear tefillin all day. They stopped that. They could not maintain focus for a whole day. Rabbi Moshe of Kusi went around and told people, listen, I understand you're afraid to wear tefillin, but you need to wear tefillin. Just for the time of davening, you can have that kind of focus. Just for that time of davening, you can maintain that kind of physical purity. So if a woman would put on tefillin, she's making an announcement about herself. Like, I am at such a high level that even though I'm not required to wear these, I'm doing it anyway. And even though it requires such a high spiritual level of focus, I'm doing it anyway. And that's not appropriate. That's considered ostentatious. The Talmud does record a Jewish woman who wore tefillin. And that, no, not Rashi's daughters. That is a myth. Right. People say that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. Rashi's daughters did not wear tefillin. There's no historical basis for that. Oh, really? What I did read was that how did the mistake come about? Why do people say Rashi's daughters wore tefillin? Because when their father, Rashi's daughters recorded Rashi's commentary on the Torah. Rashi's daughters were probably some of the most learned women in Jewish history. They were not only Rashi's daughter who recorded his commentary, they were also the mothers of the Tosafists. So the Taisvais, the Tosafists, these were the mothers of the Tosafists. You can imagine what the conversations were probably like in their house. Rashi's daughters did not wear tefillin. Where the myth probably came from is that when Rashi was elderly, they helped their father put on tefillin. And so maybe that's where it came from. But the Talmud does record a woman in Jewish history who wore tefillin, and that was Michal Bas Shaul. Michal, the daughter of King Shaul, was the wife of King David, and she wore tefillin. The fact that the Talmud has to reference a woman 1,000 years before their time who wore tefillin shows that no woman in their time wore tefillin. They had to reach as far back as 1,000 years to say there was a woman who wore tefillin. It was Michal Bas Shaul. Not all the sages condoned that. Some of the reasons given why it was okay for her to wear tefillin is because for her cross-dressing wouldn't have been an issue because she was a princess and she wouldn't be mixing amongst men. She was a princess and she was of a very high spiritual and physical stature. She was able to maintain the kind of purity necessary. And a Kabbalistic reason given for that also was that she actually had a male soul. And that's a reason why she actually didn't have children. So that's another crazy idea. She obviously was a woman and she was obligated in the female mitzvahs. But she did have a male soul and I guess it needed to be channeled through tefillin.
She is who?
Michal, the daughter of Shaul. She's the one who saved David HaMelech's life. Remember when her father was chasing after him and she put like a doll or something, a figure in the bed and said he was sleeping. And meanwhile, she helped him out the window. That was Michal, the daughter of Shaul. So that's why women don't wear tefillin. Women also don't put on tzitzis. And that's another mitzvah that we're going to look at today. And for some of the same reasons, tzitzis is considered a male garment. And if a woman puts on tzitzis, and she's not obligated to, it's considered that she's being spiritually ostentatious. Now, the Rebbe in a letter spoke about the spiritual effect of tefillin and said then, well, why don't women put on tefillin? How are they going to get those spiritual effects? So he says that women who are exempt from tefillin because it's a time-bound mitzvah, he quotes from the Arizal. The famous mystic, the Arizal, writes, "Ba'aseis hazachar es ha-mitzvah, when the male does the mitzvah, ein mehatzayrech shagam hanashim ta'asena levada. It is not necessary for the woman to do it on their own. Ki kvar nechlelas imay, be'eis she'aisa aisa mitzvah, because she's already included with him at the time when he does that mitzvah." So when a woman's husband puts on tefillin, and I'm pretty sure this applies to single women as well, they have a male half, a male counterpart, when they put on tefillin, that includes them. And then the Rebbe gives another pointer. And he says that. He references the Talmud. The Talmud asks, Nashim b'mai zachyan, how do women get merit for Torah study? We're not obligated in Torah study. How do we get women? And the Talmud actually starts previously, and the Talmud says like this, The promise that Hashem gives the woman for the future to come is greater than the promise that he gives the men. And the Talmud quotes from the Nevi Yeshaya, and it says, Nashim sha'anana is kaimna. You woman at leisure, get up. Listen to what I'm about to say. Barnais baitchais, secure daughters. So he calls them Nashim sha'ananais, woman at leisure, and he calls them secure daughters. It's a higher promise than was given to men. And the Talmud asks, why are they given this promise? And that's because they are enablers. When they enable their husband to study Torah, when they enable their children to study Torah, taking them to study, allowing their husbands to go study, encouraging them, waiting for them with dinner. And I know that's very stereotypical, but that's okay. When they do that, they get a greater reward than the men. Being an enabler gives us the greater reward. So we get the effect. So the Rebbe says for tefillin, when we encourage our children to put on tefillin, when we encourage our husbands to put on tefillin, when we enable men to put on tefillin, we get the effect of the mitzvah. The ideas that we're going to learn apply to us too. We're going to talk about subsuming our wisdom within Hashem's wisdom that applies to us too. The effect isn't directly by us putting on tefillin. The effect is by us encouraging people to put on tefillin and by our male counterpart putting on tefillin. Then we get the effect. But the effect is the same for us as well. Okay, so we're on page, I have two booklets here. So I'm not sure if you're on page, you have a 24-page booklet, then you're on page 6. If you have a 21-page booklet, then I think we're on page 5. So up until now, we were looking at the general intention in a mitzvah. The general intention is a mitzvah is we're subsuming our soul within Hashem. But now there's more particular ways of surrendering to Hashem with particular aspects of our soul. The Derech Prat, specifically, bitfillin, libatel vilikal b'chinas chachmasai uvinasai shebenafshei alekes, b'chinas chachmasai uvinasai shel einseif baruchu, hamlubashais derech prat, v'parshies kadesh v'hayaki v'yacha. Specifically, through tefillin, he should intend that the attributes of wisdom and understanding, which are in his divine soul, should be nullified and absorbed into the attributes of wisdom and understanding of the blessed Ein Sof. These being closed in particular in the passages of Kadesh and V'hayaki Yiviyacha. So I should have prefaced by saying that there's 4 Torah passages in tefillin. They are Kadesh li kol bachar, consecrate every firstborn to me. V'haya ki yiviyacha, and it will be when Hashem will bring you into the land. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And v'haya im shemoa tishma'u, and it will be when you will listen. These 4 passages in tefillin connect to 4 aspects of the mind. And you're going to say, 4 aspects of the mind, all along we're talking about 3 aspects of the mind. Well, that's true. But we're talking about Chachma, Bina, and Da'at. And for our purposes over here, Da'at is actually divided into 2. And I'll tell you why. So let's first talk about Chachma and Bina. Chachma is that first flash of inspiration. You know, sometimes you're like in a quandary, you can't think of a solution. And all of a sudden, you get this like flash of inspiration. Suddenly everything is light to you. If I grab you at that moment and say, what did you get? You can't even talk to me now. You don't know what you got. You just know that you got it. That's the first step, chachma. And then there's bina. Bina is now fleshing out the ideas, asking questions, the give and take, so that you can understand it well and own the idea. After you have that inspiration, if you don't sit with it and flesh it out, you may lose it. You have to be able to dissect and ask questions, have the back and forth, the analysis. That's bina. And then there is da'at. Da'at is emotional attachment to whatever you're learning. When the Alter Rebbe speaks about what da'at is, he brings the verse from the Torah, Va'adam yada es chava ishay. And Adam knew his wife Chava, which means union. Knowledge means union. Somebody can understand something, somebody can get a flash of inspiration, they can understand something, but they may be emotionally detached from it. I remember that I used to go to Hebrew Academy in Long Beach for high school. One of our drivers was this Indian student, college student. Very interesting, engaging. She became like something in media. And her father was a lung doctor. And she did not get along with her father. And she would say, could you imagine my father? He's like such a crazy person. He's a lung doctor, and you would never believe it, but he smokes. You think like, you know everything you need to know, that this makes no sense for you to smoke. How are you smoking? And that's because maybe he had the chachma in place and maybe he had the bina in place, but he lacked that da'at, that emotional connection that translated what he knows into an emotional experience. There's like a disconnect between what you know and then your applied behavior. So that's da'at. It's emotionally connecting with what you're learning. So there's the chachma is the flash of inspiration. Bina is owning it, asking questions, dissecting it. And da'at is emotionally connecting with what you know. Da'at is what gives birth to love and to fear. And all of the other emotions, there are 7 emotions, but there are 6 proper emotions because we won't count malchus as one of the emotions. So there are 6 emotions. Love and fear are the main ones, and everything else are just offshoots of them. So love and fear are included in da'at. So while there are 3 intellectual faculties, for the purpose of what we're studying now, we're dividing them into 4. There's chachma, there's bina, and then there's the love of da'at, and then there's the fear of da'at. Now, when a person puts on these passages of tefillin, what they're doing is, they're nullifying their soul, their soul's attributes of wisdom and understanding of chachma and bina in Hashem's attributes of chachma and bina. So in general, we were talking about just surrendering our soul, nullifying our soul within Hashem. But now we're talking about specific aspects of our soul. What does tefillin do? When a person puts tefillin on themselves, our chachma and bina become totally subsumed and nullified within Hashem's chachma and bina. What does that mean practically? So that's what the altar is going to say right now. In these passages, both of which are found in the Tefillin, God's wisdom, chachma, and understanding, bina, are enclosed. Wisdom in the former and understanding in the latter. By putting on Tefillin, the individual's wisdom and understanding are absorbed in Hashem's. How does this find expression? Dehainu shelay lehishtamish b'chachmasei uvinasei shebenafshei bilti lahashem levadei. That is to say that he should use the wisdom and understanding that are in his soul for Hashem alone, only in pursuit of Torah and mitzvot and for understanding godliness. You can say, whoa, this is a tall order. When a person puts on tefillin, when a man puts on tefillin, and by extension, he absorbs the souls of other... By the way, we're going to talk about when we do a mitzvah, it affects all Jewish people. So, when men are putting on tefillin, it has effect on our souls. When they put on tefillin, their chachma and bina becomes totally absorbed in Hashem's chachma and bina. The soul becomes then as if nullified within Hashem. Or not as if. The soul becomes nullified within Hashem. The chachma and bina of the soul become nullified within Hashem's chachma and bina. How does that find expression? I will not use my mind for anything else besides Hashem. What does that mean? Okay, so I get it. It means I need to study Torah. I get it. It means that I need to learn about Hashem. But don't we need to use our mind for business, for any other mundane pursuits that we have? And the answer is, of course we do. But what is our agenda in using our mind in those other pursuits? There is a story of the Rebbe Rashab. This is the 5th Chabad Rebbe. And he had a chassid that opened up a business in galoshes. Galoshes are like those, you know, rubber things, those boots that you can go like waiting or something. And it was flourishing and he was suddenly like obsessed and always involved in his galoshes business. And the Rebbe Rashab looked at him one day and he said, feet in galoshes, I've seen that. But a head in galoshes? And the point is, you know, I understand you have a business. You need to use your mind in order to further your business. But never forget what your agenda is. Your agenda is Hashem. Are we identifying with Hashem or are we identifying with the business? And there's a story of a woman who needed to supplement her family's income. I think this was in the like 1960s or something. And she wanted to become a typist. So she wrote to the Rebbe for advice and for a blessing. And she said that she wants to become a typist in order to supplement her family's income. And the Rebbe said to her, you're a mother. Don't become a typist. Type if you need a type in order to supplement the family's income. But to become a typist, don't become a typist. And that's us with our business pursuits. It says in Tehillim, Yegia kapecha ki seichel, the toil of your hands when you will eat. And Chassidus focuses on that and says, it's the toil of your hands, not the toil of your heart and your mind. Your heart and your mind, they belong to Hashem. When you're involved in your business, it's not something that you identify with in a way of, this is me. No, who am I? I am a servant of Hashem. I have a business. I use my mind to engage in this business. But why am I using my mind to engage in this business? So I can be a healthy servant of Hashem. I need to earn a living. I need to give tzedakah. I'm doing this all with an agenda of serving Hashem. And then when that's our agenda, then when we're using our mind in business, we're using our mind for Hashem. Bilti laHashem levade. It's only for Hashem. We have to remember how we identify. It's so important to never lose focus of who we truly are. We're servants of Hashem. We're channels of His light in this world, and every physical encounter that we have has to be an expression of that. Whether it's eating or driving or business, it's literally just channeling Hashem. And on one hand, you can say, oh my gosh, this is too much for me. On the other hand, it is the most freeing movement, the most freeing mode to be in. I am simply a channel of the divine. I have no side agenda. I'm not a typist. My head are not in galoshes. I identify with Hashem. Okay, so that was about the Chachma and Bina. Now, V'chein libatel v'likalel b'chinas hada'as shebenafshei ha'kailel chesed u'gevura shehein yira v'ahava shebelibai. Similarly, he should intend that the attribute of da'at, the third of the three components of intellect in his soul, which includes both the chesed, kindness, and gevura, severity, meaning love and fear in his heart. The attribute of da'at comprises kindness and severity insofar as these attributes exist on an intellectual level. Moreover, as is explained in the end of chapter 3, the profound and involved meditation that characterizes the level of da'at actually creates love and fear insofar as they exist independently on an emotional level. So the intention in putting on tefillin is, first of all, to subsume the chachma and bina, the wisdom and the understanding in Hashem's wisdom understanding. And second of all, to subsume the da'at, which includes love and fear. Bivchinas da'as ha'elyain, ha'kayel chesed u'gavura, ha'melubash v'parshies shema v'hayem shemaya. The faculty of da'as then should be nullified and absorbed into the attribute of the higher knowledge, da'at ha'elyon, which is Hashem's faculty of da'as as it exists in the world of Atzilus, which comprises kindness and severity and which is clothed in the passage of Shema and Vahaya im Shemaya. So when a person subsumes their da'at within Hashem's da'at, how do they do it? Simply by an act of putting on tefillin. The act draws Hashem's will upon the soul, and it's a natural effect, a natural spiritual effect, that a person's chachma and bina are going to be subsumed within Hashem's chachma and bina, that their da'at is going to be subsumed within Hashem's da'at. And when a person's da'at is subsumed within Hashem's da'at, it means that their love and fear is subsumed within Hashem's love and fear. And the Alter Rebbe doesn't spell it out over here, but the Rebbe Rashab explains that just like he said, our chachma and bina should be only used for Hashem, our love and our fear should only be used for Hashem. And wouldn't that be amazing? We would be the most liberated people on planet Earth if all that we loved was Hashem and all that we feared was Hashem. And of course, loving Hashem means loving our fellow Jew. In fact, there's a story where the Mittler Rebbe, this is the son of the author of the Tanya, was at a Farbrengen with fellow Hasidim. He wasn't yet the Rebbe. And one of the Hasidim raised a toast and he said, Hashem should bless me that I should have true love for him, l'chaim. And the Mittler Rebbe raised a toast and he said, Hashem should bless me that I should have true love of my fellow Jew, l'chaim. And then an argument broke out. Which is greater, loving Hashem or loving a fellow Jew? And went on for weeks until they brought the question to the Alter Rebbe. And this is what he said. Loving God and loving one's fellow Jew are both equally engraved in the neshama, ruach, and nefesh, which is the soul of every Jew. Nevertheless, it is explicitly stated, and this is by the prophet Malachi, Ahavti eschem, amar Hashem, I have loved you, declares God. From this we can conclude that the love of one's fellow Jew is superior, because it involves loving what one's beloved loves. Hashem is our beloved. He loves the Jews. When we love what he loves, that's greater. And so loving our fellow Jew is part of loving Hashem. If we can just use our love and fear only for Hashem, that would be the most liberating thing. And that's what we're supposed to do. And tefillin engenders that within us, the Jewish people. Now, this is not just a Kabbalistic idea. This is actually brought down in the code of Jewish law. The Shulchan Aruch talks about what's the effect of tefillin supposed to be. This accords with the statement of the Shulchan Aruch. This is the code of Jewish law. That while putting on tefillin, one should intend to make one's heart and brain subservient to Hashem. So that is how Jewish law codifies the mitzvah of tefillin. And I will read to you from the code of Jewish law. The Shulchan Aruch, this is in Or HaChaim 7:25. The Shulchan Aruch codifies like this. One should have in mind when putting them on, and this is the tefillin, that God commanded us to place these four passages, which contain the unity of his name and the Exodus, on the arm opposite the heart and on the head opposite the brain, so that we may remember the miracles and wonders that he did for us, which indicate his unity, and that he is omnipotent in heaven and on earth to do with them as he wills. And also in order to subjugate to God one's soul, which resides in the brain, as well as his heart, which houses one's main physical desires and thoughts. Through this, he will remember his creator and moderate his pleasure seeking. So Shulchan Aruch codifies that putting on tefillin is meant to engender subjugation of the heart and the mind to Hashem. It's different though in Jewish law and the way it is in Kabbalah. Why? Because the way it is codified in Jewish law is that this act reminds us to subject ourselves, to subjugate ourselves to Hashem. The way we're looking at it here in Tanya is this act causes us. It's a natural spiritual effect that our mind and our heart will become subjugated to Hashem. And the way it is in practical Jewish law is, as the author of the Sefer HaChinuch expresses it, Acharei ha-pa'ulais nimshachais ha-levavais. Our hearts are drawn after our actions. The mitzvahs are something that we do which causes our heart to follow. You do certain things, your heart will follow in step. There's a story, which I'm sure it's not true, and it better not be true, but it's a good story that illustrates this point. And that is about this man who really didn't like his wife. So this was at a time where divorce was not in vogue. Just people in the Jewish community didn't do that unless there was a scandal. But just because you don't like her, you just can't get rid of her. So he didn't know what to do. So he goes to the rabbi and says, I need advice. I don't like her. He said, you don't like her or you actually hate her? He said, I actually hate her. This is getting worse by the moment, I'm sorry. And he said, do you hate her so much that you actually wouldn't care if like something happened to her? And he said, yeah, that much. And I said, okay, I have advice for you. You know, it says that if somebody makes a pledge to tzedakah and then they don't follow up on the pledge, then, you know, something bad can happen to their wife. So maybe you want to make a pledge to tzedakah and then you don't pay it up and then, you know, you will have moved things along in the direction that you wanted them to be. And he said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. And I said, one thing I have to tell you, you can't just do that. You realize that people know you guys don't get along that well, and then you go to shul, and we know what your means are, and you're making this pledge beyond your means, and then you just don't pay it up. Like, definitely it looks like there's a bad story going on. Could you just pretend for a little bit that you love your wife? You know, it's just going to be like a few months. Like, for example, bring her some flowers, offer to take care of the kids for a little, like do some loving kind of behaviors just to show that you love her, you know, until necessary. And he said, I could do that. So he comes home with flowers and his wife is like, something happened to him. He never buys me flowers. And she smiles at him and then he offers to help. And then a few weeks go by and he comes to the rabbi and he's crying. And he said, Rabbi, I don't know what to do. I made this exorbitant pledge to tzedakah that I cannot pay up. And I'm in love with my wife. I'm so afraid, God forbid, anything should happen to her. What are we going to do now? And the rabbi said, don't worry. You'll pay it up over a very long time. Everything will be okay. And the point of the story is that our actions breed emotions. You know, people are like wanting love to happen to them. That's not how it works. Our actions breed emotions. So simply by looking at things from the perspective of Jewish law, on a very basic level, we do certain mitzvahs, and they cause us to feel a certain way. For example, tefillin. We think about Hashem, that he took us out of Egypt, that he could do whatever he wants and in heaven and earth, and that causes us to subjugate our mind and our heart to him. Kabbalistically speaking, it goes much further. When tefillin are placed upon a person, when a person puts on tefillin, they actually draw Hashem's chokhmah, bina, and da'at upon their soul. Their soul's faculties of chokhmah, bina, and da'at, which includes love and fear, become subsumed within Hashem's love and fear. And that causes them to become totally nullified or surrendered, totally surrendered to Hashem. And automatically, their heart and their mind is subjugated to Hashem. We did not go as far as I thought we would go today, but with all the excitement here, it was kind of impossible. I hope to see you in person next week. And I know, Esther, you're out of town, but we're going to keep you on Zoom because we need to have you at class. So let's summarize what we said until now. We were talking about the fact that every mitzvah offers us an opportunity to totally surrender to Hashem. How? Because a mitzvah is pulling down Hashem's will upon our soul. When we pull Hashem's will upon our soul, we are pulling down the source of our soul upon our soul. It's like dropping a drop into the ocean. It's like putting a tiny flame within a larger fire. It loses its identity, totally becomes one with its source. And the truth is, the examples of water or fire, these are not proper examples, because our soul, when it surrenders to Hashem, loses itself on a much higher plane. Total surrender. And that's just the general surrender of every act of Torah study, of every act of mitzvah performance. But then there are specific potentials, specific properties of each and every mitzvah. Each mitzvah is connected with another limb of our soul. 248 supernal lights connected to 248 limbs of our soul, which are connected to 248 limbs of our body. And each mitzvah has a special property. We just look at the mitzvah of tefillin. The mitzvah of tefillin is related to chokhmah, bina, and da'at. When a person puts on tefillin, they are drawing down the supernal chokhmah, bina, and da'at upon their own chokhmah, bina, and da'at in their soul. And that causes these to totally surrender to Hashem, totally become subsumed within him. How does that express itself? How does that find expression? That means that a person will only use their chokhmah, their bina, their power of inspiration, their power of inquisitiveness, fleshing things out, dissecting, all of that only for Hashem. And furthermore, their love and their fear only for Hashem. And what this really does for us is help us realize that everything we can, that we do in this physical world, has to be only for Hashem. And it's not a contradiction to living a regular, normal human life. In fact, if we were to separate from regular life, that would not be the will of Hashem. Hashem wants us to be physical people, living a physical life, doing mundane things, and never to forget about him. Bechol drechecha da'ehu. Know him in all your ways. It's not just, I know him when I'm in shul, and I know him when I'm studying Torah. No, I know him when my kid is throwing a tantrum. I know him when I'm frustrated about what's going on in school. I know him when I'm stuck in traffic. I know him when I'm cooking dinner. Everything that I do is supposed to be, there's supposed to be a constant awareness of Hashem and channeling his divine energy into this world. And the mitzvahs help us connect in that way. They give us the opportunity to totally surrender to him and to find expression of him through our soul. So I'm done for class for today. And Sheila had a question.
I am trying.
I'm looking at Sheila in person. This is amazing.
This is so weird. I am trying and trying and trying to wrap my brain around this idea that when men have tefillin, that they are able to so control their behavior, so control everything.
Enjoy your day.
And yet for us to do that, that would be ostentatious. And not like I'm asking to put on tefillin, but I'm trying to wrap my brain around this idea, because when you're in shul and you see men with tefillin on, and I'm not, you know, not to be
judgmental or anything.
But the love, you know, I'm sure they're davening with great kavanah, but there's also moments that they're chatting with each other.
So it's not because they could concentrate better. It's because they have to. Men have to put on tefillin. So because they have to put on tefillin, they have no choice. Okay. They used to wear tefillin the whole day. They can't because they just can't stay that focused. So at least during prayers, we're asking them, please stay focused during prayers while you're wearing the tefillin. We who don't have to wear tefillin, how dare we put ourselves in that position? They're in that position because they have to be in that position. How dare we put ourselves in that position to say, I can maintain that level of mental focus.
That's where the ego comes in,
right.
Saying, I can do this.
I can do this. Even though I don't have to, I could.
Thank you.
Whenever we institute a new Jewish practice, it has to be rooted only for the sake of Hashem. And so that's, you know, we're talking about getting our ego out of the way. That's what it is. Is it for us if it's for Hashem? If it's for Hashem, then Hashem didn't require of us. That means that we have the effect anyway. We're lucky because we have the effect anyway. If we look at it that way, we don't have to jeopardize our spiritual integrity, and we're still getting the effect of the mitzvah. Because the men, and they are jeopardizing their spiritual integrity. They're putting themselves in a position where they may not be very focused, and they may not be having the physical purity necessary in order to do the mitzvah. So they're compromised. We're not compromised. We're just getting the spiritual effect. So...